my pleasure to introduce our colloquium speaker today, Carrie Forrest. Professor Forrest is in the physics department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He received his PhD from Princeton in 1992 for his work in experimental plasma physics. This involved working with tokamaks in nuclear fusion research. He then went on to work for a company in San Diego called General Atomics for 5 years. Then got him back to the academic world in 97 at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's won distinguished awards, including the Humboldt Fellowship and the Packard Fellowship. And he's been pretty busy for the last 5 years, building a large experiment, the Madison Dynamo Experiment, which we're going to get to hear about today. So please join me in welcoming him.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Is it close enough? Fine. Well, it's my pleasure to talk to you today about experiments we're doing at the University of Wisconsin, studying magnetic field generation in flowing liquid metals. And I must say from the outset that these are fairly fundamental experiments. We're not attempting to replicate any particular astrophysical body. Rather, these are basic experiments. But it has as an application understanding some processes that happen in planets and stars. So, also, before I begin, I should acknowledge that this is the result of a big team effort, including the effort of two superstar graduate students who just finished, and an engineering team that played a big role in constructing the experiment. So, as a means of introduction, let's just talk a little bit about some nearby dynamos. The Earth and other planets have magnetic fields, and if you look at the Earth in particular, we know that its magnetic field is probably generated by flows of liquid metal inside the Earth. In the center, there's a solid core that rotates at some rate that's different than the outside. And remarkably, it's primarily a dipole that is aligned with the rotation axis of the Earth. And I show here the results from a 3D numerical simulation of the Earth's magnetic field. And I call attention to the fact that first, the magnetic field that sticks out of the Earth that we see is mostly a dipole. That's the part that sticks up at the top and in at the bottom. But deep within the Earth is structure that is quite a bit more complicated. So, for example, the magnetic field inside the Earth is probably pointing mostly in the east-west direction. Okay? And that's something that you can't observe in the Earth. It's very hard to stick a probe inside the Earth just because of the distances. But if we could do something like this in the laboratory, we could actually measure that. This is a movie of the Earth's magnetic field that's been reconstructed from data taken over the last 400 years or so. And I think this deserves an Academy Award. It's quite remarkable. What's happened is the part of the magnetic field which is left after you subtract off the steady dipolar part of the magnetic field, and it's been projected back to the core mantle boundary. And what you see is this is 1600s, and as it evolves, you see that the Earth's magnetic field, at least at that point, is quite dynamic. It's changing in time. It has spatial structure. And evidently, there's something. The processes that are related to magnetic field generation have something to do with flows, probably turbulent flows, deep inside the core. You can ask, what role do those fluctuations play, say, in producing the large-scale magnetic field that we observe, the dipolar part that sticks out? We can look at another dynamo that's nearby, namely the sun's and its magnetic field. The sun's magnetic field is generated by flows that take place in the outer part of the sun. Turns out that the sun, like the Earth, probably has something like a rigid core inside, but it has a free surface on the outside. And we can, just by looking at the sun, you can see plasma behavior, which is related to the magnetic field that sticks out of the sun. This is essentially the same movie that I showed you for the Earth, except we haven't removed the mean. And this is showing you regions of blue and yellow, which are the components of the magnetic field which stick into and out of the sun. And what you see is, if you look at this is sort of one cross-section of the sun. It's very, very dynamic. And again, this is the total magnetic field. So the mean magnetic field, if it exists, is quite a bit smaller even than the fluctuations we observe. You'll also see that these sunspots come and go with a 22-year cycle. The average part, however, although it's quite a bit smaller, does show us that there is a dipolar part to the magnetic field. If you average an azimuth, that there's a dipolar part which exists sometimes, but this changes directions every 11 years, and sometimes it even gets very weak. So there's a phase between 1992 and 1995 when the dipolar part goes away and most of the structure is actually concentrating near the equator. So I show you all of this just to point out that geophysical and solar dynamos exist. They have tremendous time variation. The structure of the magnetic field, which is generated and representative of the flows inside these bodies, is complex. And they beg the question, how are these magnetic fields generated? First person who asked this question was probably Joseph Larmor, who asked the question in a paper in 1919, how could a rotating body such as the sun become a magnet? And his hypothesis was that it's possible for the internal cyclical motion to act after the manner of the cycle of a self-exciting dynamo and maintain a permanent magnetic field from insignificant beginnings at the expense of some of the energy of the internal circulation. And that's what this talk is going to be about. So in the rest of the talk, I'm going to organize it in the following way. We'll talk about what self-excited dynamos are, and I'll give you a picture, try to describe to you how it is that magnetic fields can be generated from motion, and then talk about what I like to refer to as the standard model of the MHD self-excited dynamo. And then, after that, this is sort of a tutorial phase, I'll talk about dynamo experiments. A number of laboratories around the world are trying to build dynamos or have built dynamos that use liquid sodium as a conducting fluid and are producing magnetic fields that can be studied quite actively. Okay? And then I'll talk about experiments that we're doing at the University of Wisconsin and show you some results from the experiment that I'm involved with. So the first thing I would like to talk about is self-excited dynamos. What are self-excited dynamos? And there's sort of a model for this. Imagine that you have a very simple disk, which is located here, which is some strongly conducting metal, and imagine that it's rotating, okay? And now let's put some seed magnetic field through it. We know that because of the Lorentz term in an Ohm's law, there's an EMF, an electromotive force generated between the rotation axis and the edge of the disk. And now if you hook up a magnet, but say using some brushes and some wires and so forth, that can take advantage of that electromotive force, you can actually drive current in the magnet, which either reinforces or reduces the magnetic field that you started with. Okay? And this gives you the possibility, if you hook it up in the right way, to have either positive or negative feedback. And if you have positive feedback, then it turns out that this system can produce a magnetic field. Now, one can write down what the circuit equations are that describe something like this, and you can show that this is a very straightforward linear differential equation that governs how the current in the magnet behaves versus time. And you can see that it has a simple exponential growing or dance solution depending upon this term out front, where omega is the rotation frequency, R is the resistance of the coil, and L is some mutual inductance between this coil and the disk. If this thing out here is larger than 1, the system has a growing magnetic field. It becomes a dynamo. Okay? And this is very important. It tells you something right away, which is that the rotation rate needs to be sufficiently large, the resistance needs to be sufficiently small, and the inductance has to be of the right type. Okay? Of course, that's not all there is here. There's also an equation of motion, something that governs the rate at which this thing rotates in the first place. And we haven't talked about that, but you can see that as soon as a magnetic field is generated, then currents will start to flow across the magnetic field that exert a torque back on the disk and slow it down. And so you have to then consider the back reaction of the self-generated magnetic field to fully understand the system. Before I move on, I'm going to come back and use this parameter, but you can see that this is of exactly of a form which is something like the conductivity of the material times a characteristic size. Mu naught A is something like the inductance here, and V is a characteristic velocity of the system. This combination of parameters we call the magnetic Reynolds number, and it turns out that that's the parameter that needs to be large enough for the system to be a dynamo. Now, this principle that I just showed you is essentially what Wernher von Siemens used when he built the first self-excited dynamo in the mid-1800s. So the self-excited dynamo used ferromagnetic materials and a very particular geometry to get a self-excited current flowing in a machine. Before this time, people used permanent magnets to produce the seed field. Okay, so it was only after this time that the electromagnet was self-generating in some sense. And he was the person who coined the dynamo electric principle as the phrase that we're using now to describe astrophysical dynamos. Okay, so what I just showed you is a very simple mechanical model. It consists of a solid rotating chunk of material. It consists of some wires which have insulation around them, and it's clearly not a liquid metal. Imagine what would happen to this machine if you heated it up to the melting point of the metal and stripped away all of the insulators from the conductors, and the currents were allowed to flow wherever they wanted. It becomes a much more complex problem, right? And so it requires more complex machinery, mathematical machinery, to understand how one might construct a dynamo in something like the Earth. So this brings me to the next part of my talk, which is, what is the standard model of an MHD dynamo? Okay, first of all, we need to talk a little bit about how we describe a system like this. The mathematics we use all comes down to solving something called the magnetic induction equation, which you get by combining pre-Maxwell's equations, an Ohm's law that describes how current is generated in a moving liquid metal, an Ampere's law, and Faraday's law. You combine these and you get what looks like a diffusion equation for the magnetic field over here, except there's also a term due to motion, a source term, which is due to motion of the fluid across a magnetic field. The ratio of these two terms, okay, you can, just scaling arguments, you can relate the ratio of these two by a dimensionless number, which is the magnetic Reynolds number that I just showed you for the disk, okay? So when this number is large, the induction term dominates over the diffusive term. The diffusive term is loss of magnetic energy due to resistivity. And so when the magnetic Reynolds number is large, generation of magnetic field dominates over the dissipation of the magnetic field. And of course, just like for the disk, we also need something like an equation of motion, which for us is a Navier-Stokes-like equation modified by the presence of a Lorentz force acting back on the fluid. Okay, how is it that a fluid flow could amplify a magnetic field? Well, it turns out in the limit that the magnetic Reynolds number is large, you can think about magnetic field lines as being frozen into a moving fluid. So imagine the following situation. Imagine that I have a magnetic field which is penetrating a large volume of say, liquid metal or some other conducting fluid like a plasma. And then suddenly I start a motion of this fluid to the right in some region in the middle where I have a shear flow. The flow moves to the right like this. So there's a velocity field that I add to this magnetic field. And now if this magnetic field is frozen into the moving fluid, you can visualize the magnetic field as evolving in this way, where it starts to get stretched out to the in the rightward direction above the midplane and to the leftward direction below the midplane. And what you end up seeing is that there's a component to the magnetic field which is induced transverse to the original seed field that you started with. This isn't a dynamo, That is, it doesn't lead to self-excitation because there's no positive feedback involved, right? The self-generated magnetic field doesn't reinforce the original seed field that you started with, but it shows you how a magnetic field can be generated. If you let the system evolve for a long time, this magnetic field can get stretched out a very large distance to the right and back towards the left, which corresponds to a very, very strong transverse field being generated from a relatively weak initial field. Okay? So now the question is, okay, we have a simple model for understanding how to visualize magnetic field lines. Can we construct a simple model, say, for a spherical dynamo that would describe how magnetic fields could self-generate in a spherical flow? And this, and so it turns out that the process I just showed you is the first building block in how this might happen. So imagine a very simple flow which consists of a flow inside a sphere, and the simplest of all flows that you might think about is one in which maybe the center is rotating at a different rate than the surface, so that the flow at the equator is faster than the flow at the surface. Okay? Now imagine two field lines which maybe correspond to an initial dipole field that's a seed field. What happens if we let those fields get infected by the flow? And the sort of model that you get is that these field lines just simply get stretched out because the center is the equatorial region is moving more rapidly than the areas above and below. You can see that there's a very strong component to the magnetic field which is in the east-west direction induced by this simple axisymmetric differential rotation. This is what's known as the omega effect, omega being representative of the rotation, the differential rotation that's present. Okay? But just like in the last picture, this isn't enough, right? This magnetic field that's generated, the strong magnetic field which is generated in the east-west direction, doesn't reinforce the initial field that we started with. It doesn't reinforce the dipolar field that was there to begin with. So there's no feedback. There's no positive feedback mechanism for self-generation. Now, people thought about this for a long time. They thought, what type of simple flows could I produce in a sphere which would take this field and reinforce the original seed field that you started with? And it turns out that it was very, very difficult to come up with simple flows being axisymmetric flows, to do this. And there was a very important recognition of this in 1933 when Cowling published probably the most famous of all dynamo theorems, or anti-dynamo theorems, I should say, where he noted that when the magnetic field and the fluid motions are symmetric about an axis, no stationary dynamo can exist. So it turns out that no matter what you do, you can't find an axisymmetric flow which can provide this positive feedback that's necessary for self-excitation. Okay? And the way out of this model was, in essence, invented in 1955 by Eugene Parker, when he said, okay, let's not worry about axisymmetry, what sort of non-axisymmetric flows might I be able to use which would provide that positive feedback? And his idea was that if you take that strong toroidal magnetic field this strong east-west magnetic field that I showed you, and you now advect it using helical fluctuations, say fluctuations which would be due to some fluid moving upward and twisting due to the Coriolis force, you can take these field lines and twist them in such a way that they reinforce the original dipolar field. And the type of motion you would get in that case, and this is just an artistic rendering, is that the field lines get pulled and they get twisted, and now the magnetic field which is generated is exactly of the right type to reinforce in some average sense the dipole that you started with. Okay? And so this is the second step. This then takes that strong amplified east-west field and reinforces the original seed field, and the positive feedback becomes possible. So this effect was labeled the alpha effect, and there are various reasons why this might be so. One is that alpha looks a little bit like a twisting helical plume moving upward, I suppose. Another reason is it's the first Greek alphabet in an expansion that was used for describing this. And people went on to describe this effect in terms of a theory that's come to be known as mean field electrodynamics. The idea being, if you can describe the magnetic field and the velocity field in terms of a mean part and a fluctuating part, you can show that the average current, the mean current, can be related to the parts generated by the mean flow and the magnetic flow, but also due to a nonlinear beating of the fluctuating parts of the field. Okay? And I'll come back to this later. It turns out we think we have strong evidence for observations of such a current, such a turbulence-driven current, in our experiment. This EMF was then described in terms of a coefficient alpha, which produces an EMF in the direction of the existing magnetic field that generates the field that you see, this dipolar part from the toroidal magnetic field. Okay. So in something, then, just to summarize, the standard dynamo model is you start with a seed field, which might be something like dipolar. You have a differential rotation that produces a east-west direction. Oh, I went too fast. There we go. The toroidal magnetic field, which is generated, the part in the east-west direction, ends up being on the order of the magnetic Reynolds number times the seed field, or at least that's how it should be ordered, which means that in something like the Earth, where the magnetic Reynolds number is on the order of several hundred, the toroidal field might be expected to be several orders of magnitude larger than the poloidal field. Whether or not that's true comes down to details. And then the final part is that some symmetry-breaking helical fluctuations generate a east-west current, which is due to these symmetry-breaking fluctuations. And this current in the east-west direction reinforces the original seed field. Okay. So the current state of the theory is much more advanced than what I just showed you. The current state of the theory is to solve the coupled MHD equations, and one can do this on big computers. And one can show that magnetic fields can be generated, like the picture I showed you earlier. So you might ask me, as an experimentalist, why do experiments? And I'd like to use a quote from Enrico Fermi here. In magnetohydrodynamics, one should not believe the product of a long and complicated piece of mathematics if it's unsupported by observation. And so there are always good reasons to do experiments. And there are more specific answers to this question, and I can go through them here, but the basic idea comes down to the fact that computers are limited in resolution and speed, and there's no way that we can actually simulate all of the spatial scales necessary to understand something like the Earth at this stage. And in the case is even worse for the sun. And that's because the Reynolds numbers for something like the Earth are very, very large. And it turns out that this same property is true in liquid metal experiments. So this brings me to the next part of my talk, which is let me just give you a quick review of what it means to be a self-exciting dynamo experiment, and I'll show you experiments which have produced magnetic fields. So before I show you the experiments, let me just outline the type of thinking that we use when we're designing experiments. Okay? So if you're going to design an experiment, you have to ask yourself the following type of question. What type of flow is it that I want to actually produce in the laboratory that might produce its own magnetic field? And so you can simplify the problem. That's what we do as physicists. We reduce the problem to its simplest form. So for example, if you have to choose a geometry, I could choose a sphere. We're stuck in the experiments that we do with something like uniform conductivity. It's hard to get away from that. It has a certain size. Maybe it's surrounded by an insulating region. And now you can ask, is there a velocity field that leads to a growing magnetic field, ignoring any back reaction of the velocity field on the magnetic field at this point? This greatly simplifies the problem. All you have to do is solve the induction equation, because you believe the velocity field is not varying yet. It's not a nonlinear coupled set of equations. Rather, it's a simple linear equation where you simply specify what the velocity field is. Okay? So once you specify the geometry and you specify a shape for the velocity field, you can solve this equation just using separation of variables. It's a simple linear equation, and you can find the eigenmodes and the eigenfrequencies that describe how the eigenmodes behave versus time. And the general solution of this equation looks something like this. At zero magnetic Reynolds number, when the flow is stationary, all of the eigenmodes are damped. Any magnetic field that you put on in its initial condition will simply decay away due to resistive dissipation. But as you increase the velocity, or increase the magnetic Reynolds number, the damping rate, the eigenfrequency of the problem, becomes less and less until you get to some critical point above which the least damped eigenmode becomes a growing eigenmode, or you get a dynamo. Okay? So in our design process, what we do is we build codes that solve the magnetic induction equation for different velocity fields, and we search for velocity fields which can produce a magnetic field above some critical magnetic Reynolds number. For us, this critical magnetic Reynolds number is typically between 50 and 100 for the geometries that I'll show you. Okay? And it turns out that you can make these types of magnetic Reynolds numbers using flows of liquid sodium. Liquid sodium, why liquid sodium? Well, liquid sodium is much more conducting than any other liquid, melts at a relatively low temperature, about 100 degrees Celsius. And if you work out the numbers, because sodium's a relatively light element, it doesn't take that much power to actually spin the flow up, okay? It takes on the order of 100 kilowatts, which is, you know, just a good outboard motor as far as we're concerned here. And this means a volume for us, you can consider a device which is a sphere that has a diameter on the order of a meter, okay? And this assumes that you can produce flows inside the liquid metal which are on the order of 15 meters per second, which is a tire on a car going about 50 miles an hour, so not all that fast, actually. So several experiments have already been done that have produced their own magnetic fields. And the first to do this was an experiment that was done in Riga, Latvia. And I show you a picture of the experiment here. It's a little bit complicated. It involves three different chambers. In the central chamber, there's a flow which is downward and twisting. You'll see that this theme of helical flows comes back again and again in dynamo experiments. That flow that goes down the center returns back up in the pink channel just outside there, and then there's a stationary flow outside, which is in yet a third chamber. Okay? If you turn this experiment on and you increase the rotation rate, which is shown here in blue, there's a critical rotation rate above which a magnetic field, an oscillatory magnetic field, begins to grow. It grows up, and there are lots of oscillations in here, so this envelope is just representative of the growth rate. It grows at some rate, and then it saturates. Okay? This experiment showed growth and saturation in this fairly contrived geometry. Okay? You can make it even worse. This is an experiment which was done in Karlsruhe, Germany. This is 2001, in which they took essentially, they put a bunch of those helical channels together in one large cylindrical vessel in an attempt to mock up the types of flows that you might have in a rotating convecting system. And in each of these channels inside this disk are helical flows. The flows are moving down, and vanes make the flow twist in a particular way. And it turns out that this experiment also generated its own magnetic field. This is perhaps even a little more interesting than the last one because you have a bunch of small-scale flows producing a large-scale magnetic field. The magnetic field which was generated here had spatial structure which was on the size of the device. Okay? For this experiment, I think it was 50 Gauss, 50 to 100 Gauss. Okay. So this brings me to the last part of my talk, which are experiments that we're doing on dynamos at the University of Wisconsin. So the two experiments I just showed you leave a couple of big questions unanswered. So perhaps all of it comes down to the first question, in fact. What happens if the velocity field is not strongly constrained by these pipes and baffles, right? Both cases I showed you, the velocity field was exactly what was imposed by the structure that was built. Okay, so there was no possibility for the velocity field to change in an easy way as the magnetic field increased in amplitude. And then another important question, I didn't show this, is what role does the turbulence play in the self-excitation process? Both of the experiments I showed you could essentially, the self-excitation threshold was essentially that would be predicted by a laminar theory in which no fluctuations were important, okay? And we learned, as I showed you in the standard model of the MHD dynamo, that fluctuation-driven currents could very well be very most important in something like the core of the Earth, when you need symmetry-breaking helical fluctuations to provide the feedback cycle. So there was nothing in these experiments which addressed the role of turbulence in current generation. Okay? Does this mean field theory makes sense? The theory that's been around since the mid-50s that we base some of our intuition on. So we built an experiment. We built a spherical experiment, and the experiment was based on a flow that was put forward in the late 80s, and it's shown here. Let me describe it to you. So there's an axis of symmetry to this flow, which is horizontal in this picture, and that's because the experiment is laid out that way, and it corresponds to It's an axisymmetric flow in which is built up from two propellers that provide thrust out along the poles. They're spinning. One propeller is spinning one direction. The other propeller is spinning the opposite direction. Okay, and because of that, there's a component of the velocity which is in the toroidal or phi direction, which is around the axis of symmetry, which is one direction in one hemisphere and the opposite direction in the other hemisphere, And in addition to that, there's a flow which is out along the poles and circulates back in at the equator. The equator is running vertically here. And this flow is perhaps the simplest of all flows which produces a dipolar magnetic field. It produces a dipole field which is transverse to the symmetry axis at a magnetic Reynolds number of about 50. The predicted eigenmode, I'm showing it here in a movie format just to give you a feel for its structure. It's transverse, like I mentioned. I've penciled in the propellers in the center here, and you can see that it corresponds to a magnetic field sticking in on one side and out at the other, but there's more structure. And you can ask, what sort of physics is it in that flow which leads to the magnetic field being self-generated? So we can go back to our frozen in flux, frozen in magnetic field idea. And imagine now that we start, that we look at this this flow, and the propellers that are inside the fluid are going to be spinning in opposite directions. Start with a seed field which is transverse to the symmetry axis, which is horizontal here. And imagine what happens to those field lines as they're advected in time. What happens is, initially, those two field lines get drawn apart, and because the propellers are spinning in the opposite direction, those field lines actually get stretched and then twisted, okay? And that's the helical flow playing an important role. And then finally, those field lines get drawn back in at the equator, and the direction after they've been twisted in exactly the right way is to reinforce the original seed field that you started with. So the stretching is the amplification. The twisting and folding back on itself is the positive feedback, the geometric part of the feedback that allows the dynamo to happen. In the end, you end up with this quite tangled mess, and it turns out that resistivity ends up being important for relaxing this into the simple field that I just showed you. But this is the essence of the model that I just showed you. Okay, so you can imagine this as being a rotating system for example, that corresponded to some rotation axis which is running this way, and you have advection out in the two directions that the propellers are pulling on the fluid, from. Okay? So if you wanted to transform this picture into an Earth-like picture, the rotation axis would actually be vertical in this case. Okay? So this is the geometry that we use for our experiment. The first thing you do before running off and building an experiment, that is the first thing you do right after asking yourself if you're completely crazy for attempting to do an experiment with a cubic meter of liquid sodium, is to build an experiment using a simpler fluid to work with, like water. And we did that. We built a dimensionally identical version of the experiment I'll show you in water. It turns out that water and sodium have the remarkable property that they have nearly identical viscosities and mass densities, which means that the fluid Reynolds number in a water version of the experiment is exactly the same as the fluid Reynolds number in a sodium version of the experiment. Okay? And this is very important because it means that we can go in a water experiment, produce the flows using the same propellers, the same geometry and everything, but measure the flow accurately using laser-based diagnostics that can look through the clear water, right? And so we did that. We use lasers to measure the flow, and we make measurements of the velocity field, and we can figure out what the velocity field looks like. And the velocity field looks very, very similar to the one that I just showed you that is predicted to be a dynamo. And so never mind the details here. These are different measurements. I do call attention to the error bars here. The error bars, it turns out, are representative of the fluctuation level, not the accuracy with which we measure the mean flow. And so the reason I mention that is to point out that the flows that we produce are very, very turbulent, and we make a prediction for whether or not the system is going to excite based upon a mean flow. And so there's an uncertainty in our prediction which does not take account of the fact that, in fact, the flow is very turbulent. Okay? And that'll be important later. This flow, one can work out the types of velocities we have is when we have rotation rates, which are sort of in the range of up to 1,800 RPMs. We produce velocities which are on the order of 10 to 20 meters per second, which is what I said we needed to generate. And it's predicted to become a dynamo. We can take this measured flow, put it into our calculations, and predict when it will start to grow, when the magnetic field might start to grow. And it's predicted that for a input power in excess of about 100 kilowatts, this flow is predicted to be a dynamo. Okay? So with that design process in hand, that took several years. In fact, that was quite a detailed set of measurements to design a flow which would work. It involved testing many different propellers to find the right geometry. With that, we built a sodium version of the experiment. And this shows a picture of the laboratory. In the center, the snowball-looking thing is the sphere. It's covered by insulation because sodium needs to be hot in order to be molten. The sphere is 1 meter in diameter. Okay. We have 300 gallons of liquid sodium which sit in the floor when we're not using it. And what happens is we can pressurize this vessel and make the sodium go into the experiment. When something goes wrong, if something were to go wrong, it would simply flow back into the floor, into the holding tank in the floor. And we have two 100 horsepower motors, one at each end. And in the middle here is this is the critical piece of technology in the experiment, which is the seal, the mechanical seal that allows us to drive these propellers, which are inside that you can't see. Okay. In addition to all of that, there's lots of vessel heating and cooling that is necessary to bring everything up to the melting point of sodium. It turns out that when you're driving 200 horsepower of mechanical energy into this experiment, it starts to heat up by itself. And we have to switch into a cooling mode. And the reason is very simple, that liquid metals, their conductivity begins to drop as the temperature goes up, like any metal. And so by keeping the sodium just above the melting point, we keep the conductivity as high as possible, or the magnetic Reynolds number as big as possible. Okay? Okay, so now I'm going to show you some results. And The results come from some diagnostics, and I should talk about those first. We do experiments in which we can apply a seed field using a series of coils that we have outside the experiment. And we have magnetic probes which measure the radial component of the magnetic field all over the surface of the sphere. Turns out you only have to measure the normal component because that allows you to expand the external magnetic field in spherical harmonics in a way that you can fully determine. We resolve a certain number of spherical harmonics. We can also stick probes into the flow. We have stainless steel pipes that stick in to the flow, and as long as we're not spinning too fast, these probes don't vibrate too quickly, and we can make measurements of the internal magnetic field. And so the experiment I'll describe to you now is perhaps the simplest geometry you can imagine, where we take this flow and we apply to it an axial magnetic field from two coils which are in a Helmholtz configuration, and the magnetic field we're going to apply to the experiment shares the same symmetry as the mean flow. Okay? So it turns out when you do that, what you might expect is something like this. If you take this magnetic field and the velocity field that we measure, we expect that the inward flow at the equator will pull the magnetic field in, okay, and compress the field in this region but weaken it out here and distort it in some way. Okay, and that corresponds to currents which are flowing around the axis. But in addition, because there's strong differential rotation, okay, remember there's also now this differential rotation, the propellers are spinning in the opposite direction, that induces a east-west component, a toroidal magnetic field, which is the omega effect that I showed you earlier, right? That's this twisting up of the magnetic field in the direction of the symmetry axis. Okay, and so we might expect then to measure a toroidal magnetic field inside. We have probes at these positions, all right? Here is some data. When we turn the experiment on, you can measure. So this is the magnetic field measured at six probe positions. Initially, the magnetic field is out at the black point. It's positive here. In at the purple point down here, and at the equator where at these two points here, the magnetic field is relatively weak before we turn the motors on. When the motors turn on, we spin the fluid up, the magnetic Reynolds number goes up to something like 130 in this experiment. What you see is that, first of all, there are tremendous fluctuations in the magnetic field. What we're seeing is we're seeing the fact that the flow is very, very turbulent, and the magnetic field which is induced is representative of the turbulence which is inside the flow. Okay? Another thing you'll note is that the mean value is significantly changed from the value before the flow is turned on. So these flows are producing magnetic fields, they're producing a mean value, and there are fluctuations which are important. The fluctuating parts are big, the average value has changed. For the aficionados, we've gone through a lot of experiments on characterizing the turbulence. And we find that we have turbulence which is representative of Kolmogorov-like turbulence in the velocity field, and it advects the magnetic field in just the right way. Now, ignoring the turbulence for now, you can look at the time-averaged part of the magnetic field, and we can reconstruct what it happens to be. Okay, and I show you here the average part of the magnetic field which results from this experiment. What we find is that we have strong toroidal magnetic fields which are measured. We observe directly the omega effect that I was talking about earlier. This would be like sticking a probe in the Earth and measuring the strong east-west component deep down near the inner core. And in addition, we measure a strong distortion of the dipole field that we applied in the first place. And this just gives some data for how that's reconstructed. Never mind that for now. But what I'd like to show you is that we're now in a position to answer a very, very fundamental question from MHD, which is, in this turbulent system, does a simple Ohm's law make sense? Okay? In this term, I've written out Ohm's law, where the brackets represent some time average and some axisymmetric averaging of each of the quantities. So in this case, this is the time average axisymmetric current. This is the time average axisymmetric velocity field, which we measure in some sense from the laser Doppler velocimetry system on our water experiment. Okay, so the time average current density and the magnetic field are measured using probes. We can figure out what these are by simply averaging for long periods of time on this experiment. The velocity field we measure on our water experiment. The magnetic fields are weak enough that we're not affecting the flow. And that means we can examine all of these terms, and we can figure out if this current is sufficient to produce this magnetic field. If it is, we don't need an additional term for the turbulence part of this, okay? So we're in a very good position to figure out if fluctuation-driven currents exist in the experiment. So we can take our data and we can look at it, and this is what we find. We can find this is the magnetic field that is induced by the currents in the flow. This is the magnetic field which would be generated by the mean velocity field and the mean magnetic field. And these are very different. They're especially different in magnitude. It turns out that the magnetic fields which are predicted due to the mean flow and the mean magnetic field are much stronger than the fields we actually observe. Okay? And it turns out that the conclusion we draw from this is that the turbulence is acting in a very diamagnetic way. It's acting to expel magnetic fields. And one can ask what form those the currents that are generated have to take. And you can actually figure out how big they are. And the parts that must be due to the fluctuating parts of the velocity field and the magnetic field are just as large as the parts which are generated by the mean flow and the mean magnetic field. Okay? And it turns out that our first indication that these existed was an even more basic observation, namely that we were able to observe that a dipole was generated, and we subsequently proved to ourselves that a dipole field can't be generated by the internal currents if the flows are axisymmetric. It turns out that the graduate student who was working on this, Eric Spence, was looking at the data, observing a dipole moment, and trying to reconstruct how that dipole field could be generated from flows. I asked him for about a year to go back and find the flow which would generate the field that we were observing. And after a year, he came back and said, there's no way it can be done. The code doesn't predict it. We subsequently proved analytically that this dipole field can't produce the field that we observed, and that one needs turbulent-driven currents to generate this. Okay, the last thing I'm going to show you is essentially our movie of the magnetic field. So this is the magnetic field observed on the surface of the sphere after you remove the applied field. So this is very similar to the movie I showed you of the Earth earlier. And what I'll call your attention to, I've turned the experiment now, I flipped it 90 degrees, so it's now running vertically. The symmetry axis runs this direction. What we observe is that there will be blobs of magnetic field which are generated in the equatorial region. The magnetic field will intermittently start to pop up with a pole sticking in one side of the sphere and out the other side of the sphere. And if you can sort of see this just by looking at the movie. And as it turns out, that's exactly the type of magnetic field that we're expecting to see being self-excited by the flow, the mean flow that we started out with. If you remember, the magnetic field we're expecting from theory corresponds to a dipole which is transverse to the symmetry axis. Okay? And what we're observing is that transiently, we can see this magnetic field grow up and then disappear with time. Okay? So it shows up and then disappears. And I'm not going to go into the details too much here, but the statistics are very non-Gaussian, which is representative of some very short, brief event that shows up. Correspondingly show that this is a very intermittent self-excitation, which all supports the hypothesis that the dynamo is coming and going. Okay, and it turns out that this, if you look at each of these self-excitation events, you can look at what the canonical one looks like, averaging over many of them. And for low rotation rates, the amplitude of the self-excited magnetic field is weak, but relatively long-lived, representative of the idea that the eddies are fairly slowly turning over because the flow is not that fast. As you increase the speed, the peak values of the magnetic fields which are generated become much larger, but they last for a much shorter period of time. Our idea is that the flow, while there's a well-defined mean flow, sometimes becomes, because it's turbulent, it will change for some fraction of the time into a flow which is fully self-excited, but then it will change back to a case where it's no longer a dynamo. And so we think we have a conjecture, which is that this flow is increasingly spending time as a dynamo. And I could go into this, but I'd rather not. I'd rather move to the summary. And say that, in summary, liquid metal experiments are beginning to look at and investigate self-excited dynamos. The ones which have worked so far have been flows that are very heavily constrained by pipes and baffles to have just the right shape for self-excitation. There's a new set of experiments underway worldwide, in fact, which are less constrained, like our experiment, where the flows are free to back react in many different ways. On the Madison experiment, we've observed transiently a dipole, which is, we have observed a dipole field, which must be generated by the turbulence on average when we apply a magnetic field. We measure a magnetic field which must be generated on average from the fluctuations. We have evidence for a mean field EMF inside the experiment. And we also observe what we think is intermittent self-excitation of the magnetic eigenmode we're hoping to see. Thank you. That's true. So we've only run the experiment at about two-thirds of the peak speed. And and the reason for that is above that speed, our probes, which were inside the experiment for this set of experiments, start to vibrate like weeds, or like reeds. and so we're nervous about them breaking off. So we've actually taken them out, and during the next set of experiments, we'll be doing them without the probes inside. But that's part of it. And the second thing is that even if we go to peak speed, we know that the flow is changing continuously. And so we expect that it's only going to become a dynamo in some statistical way. Yeah?
So my next question was, when you say intermittent, you mean that in the technical sense of dynamically intermittent?
Exactly. There's a lot of meaning attached to the intermittent term. It turns out the statistics are intermittent. So it's not only happening with random intervals, that is, it's on some of the time and off some of the time. Rather, when you look at the statistics of the self-excitation, it satisfies statistics which are representative of special of self-excitation. Yep. How important are what? Temperature differences. Ah, okay. So the thermal conductivity of sodium is very high, and in addition to that, it's turbulently mixing the flow. The temperature gradients are completely irrelevant as far as we're concerned. It would be very, very hard for us to sustain a significant temperature drop. In fact, people try to do that in rotating convection experiments, and it turns out that the flows that you get when you drive the system thermally are much, much slower than the types of flows you can get by mechanically forcing it using an impeller. In fact, that's why we do, why we use motors, because it's much more efficient at driving the velocity field that we need to get self-excitation. No. We monitor it. I mean, we measure the temperature, but it's a very weak effect. Yep.
When you monitor the turbulence in your water experiment, that must vary quite a bit over the whole sphere.
Yes.
And the other question is the turbulence must be different in space, and it's in a different direction.
Yep. Yep. It's anisotropic and it's inhomogeneous. Exactly. We've done studies of this. It turns out that one of the mean field theory predictions is that there will be currents which are generated due to inhomogeneities in the fluctuation level, and magnetic field will tend to be expelled from regions where the fluctuations are very large. You can think about magnetic fields being drawn out of that region and reducing the magnetic field in that region. We think that this is a reasonable interpretation of what we're seeing. We're seeing a reduction in the overall magnetic field due to inhomogeneities in the turbulence, for example. Yep. So that's true. All those things are true. The torque fluctuations?
Oh, yeah, you're driving it.
Yes. We can monitor in real time what the motor is doing, and you see variations in the power output, which is the torque, exactly. So yes, we monitor that. We haven't done a strong correlation analysis of that with the magnetics. Maybe we should. No. we think gravity plays a relatively unimportant role in this experiment. The inertial forces are much, much larger than the gravitational forces, which are offset in part by the pressure variation that takes place inside the tank. And so another question you might ask along those lines is, does the Earth's magnetic field plague our measurements? And we've been fairly careful to interpret, you know, to take that into account as we're looking at things. But it's the magnetic fields we're looking at are about 100 times larger than the Earth's magnetic field in general.
How do the seals work to keep the sodium from leaking out around?
Oh, that's a great question. You must be an experimentalist. So the experiment uses it's a double mechanical seal, so it has silicon carbide against stainless steel on two faces, and in the region in between we actually use oil, and so the oil is at a higher pressure than the sodium on one side and atmosphere on the other side, and there's a little bit of oil that leaks into the sodium, but because it's inert with oil, it's not an issue. So that's what we use. Is there a critical seed field? I think there isn't one theoretically, but whether is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
From the theory point of view, I don't see why. In principle, an infinitesimal seed field will still grow exponentially, right? For the experiment, we often speculate that in fact the system may self-excite in a non-linear fashion. That is, if I apply a magnetic field above some level, I might have a subcritical transition, right? And that's not. I think that's what's normally done in simulations, right? In simulations, you can't. They don't get a dynamo unless they use a subcritical kick. And so, oftentimes when we're hanging our heads wondering what to do in the experiment, we think, well, maybe if we could just apply a large enough magnetic field to kick it, it would become a dynamo and rely on some nonlinear, as yet not understood, process. So far we assume that the water experiment is the velocity field we have in the sodium experiment, and that assumption would break down if the magnetic field were large enough to induce some change in the velocity field. So we're very, very careful to study the linear limit of our applied magnetic field. So we can apply the magnetic field and make sure that we're not in some nonlinear phase, and therefore we believe that we're not affecting the velocity field. Later, when we get a magnetic field which grows up, we hope to monitor that using ultrasound. So it turns out that ultrasound can in fact measure the velocity field, but that takes some special technology.